All right, please be seated. Good morning. This morning we have one participant by phone. Justice Ann Walsh Bradley will be participating by phone, so we'll need to keep our ears ready to listen if she's asking any questions. I welcome all of you to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. It is nice to see you this morning. It is nice to be here this morning, and we appreciate your attendance. We start out this morning with Waukesha County versus EJW, 20 AP 370. Appearances, please. All right, very good. Thank you. I do have Attorney Breckenfelder having 25 minutes to start. You will receive a notice, you know, through the marshal when it's time to begin to conclude that, or maybe the lights are working now. We're doing this slightly differently than the last year when charts and colored paper was held up. And then you'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal. You'll have 30 minutes, Mr. Bosch, to present your argument. Okay? All right. Let's proceed first with Attorney Breckenfelder.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. My name is Lauren Breckenfelder, and I represent the petitioner, EJW. Today, this court is tasked with interpreting Wisconsin Statutes 51-11, which reads, a jury trial is deemed waived unless demanded at least 48 hours in advance of the time set for final hearing if notice of that time has previously been provided to the subject individual or his or her counsel. This court should hold that under the plain language of the statute, when a final hearing is adjourned, the individual retains the right to file a jury demand. Put another way, this court should hold that the deadline to file a jury demand is not restricted to the first date set for final hearing in situations where the final hearing is adjourned.
Counsel, what if there had been a request for a jury trial at the date 2 days before the first final hearing had been set, and what occurred, again, occurs in the future where that date is canceled, then another date is set for a final hearing. Do you have to make another request for a jury trial 2 days before that date? And if that date is again adjourned and a third date is set, do you have to make a request again for a jury trial for each of those times?
I think in that context, it would be left to the discretion of the circuit court to make the appropriate record. For example, if the individual files a timely jury demand and the final hearing occurs, the parties convene, but it is jointly decided that it needs to be set over for the actual jury trial, certainly I think that original jury demand would suffice. But if it's a situation perhaps like the one in this case with EJW, where the hearing was adjourned for appointment of new counsel, I think that would be a situation where the jury demand would need to be made anew.
And counsel, can I follow up on that?
Yes, of course.
So looking at the language, I'm not sure why you answer that way, because it says at least 48 hours in advance. Wouldn't it still be at least 48 hours because it's the new hearing, you're saying it would have to be made anew.
Correct.
But it's still at least 48 hours in advance. It's more than 48 hours in advance.
Correct. And I suppose let me clarify. I believe if the party's attorney files a jury demand 48 hours before, let's say, March 8th, and the parties convene, and it's just determined that the case isn't ready to proceed on that date, but it's being scheduled for a jury trial, there would be no need to file a new jury demand before the date that the final hearing is going to proceed. However, in other situations where that record is not able to be made and the final hearing is simply adjourned, certainly it would be necessary to file that jury demand 48 hours before the final hearing.
I'm not understanding when that would be the case. Because if it's made before the first time it's set, it's made at least 48 hours before the second time it's set. At least 48 hours. It may be 30 days before, but it's at least 48 hours before. So why would you ever need to make it again?
And I guess perhaps I'm getting your question confused. I guess my perspective is that if a final hearing is set and a jury demand is filed 48 hours before that final hearing, I don't think in that context the jury demand would need to be refiled if it was properly filed previously.
Okay. I was just following up on Justice Rogenczyk's question. I didn't understand when it would ever have to be made again.
So did I answer your question?
I think so.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm not hung up on that, so thank you.
Thank you. This interpretation is consistent with fundamental principles of statutory interpretation. First, we know that we need to consider the common, ordinary, and accepted meanings of the words that were selected by the legislature. And in this case, the legislature selected the words, the time set for a final hearing, to establish essentially the anchor for that 48-hour deadline. The words time set for final hearing are not commonly understood to mean the first time set for final hearing or the original time set for final hearing. Using EJW's case as an example, the March 12th date, final hearing date, was the time set for final hearing in the same way that the March 5th date was the time set for final hearing. And as such, this interpretation comports with that well-established principle of statutory interpretation. Moving on to another principle that this court is well-versed in, we do not read additional words into a statute when we are considering the plain language meaning.
How do you deal with the waiver language in the statute? The statute says a jury trial is deemed waived unless demanded at least 48 hours in advance of the time set for the final hearing. In this case, we had a time set for the final hearing. It was March 5th. The jury demand was not filed. It was waived. Now, I understand your argument is, well, the hearing wasn't held then. It was held later. But once it's waived, how do you unwaive a waiver?
I disagree that perhaps the concept of once waived, always waived is implicit in the statute. I would note that when it says if the final hearing isn't filed 48 hours before the time set for final hearing, then certainly on that final hearing date, the party can't come in and say, I want to proceed with my jury trial now. It would be waived for the purposes of that hearing. Ultimately, what this case contemplates and ultimately the question before this court is, in the context of a final hearing that's adjourned, does that individual have the right to file a jury demand 48 hours before that final hearing? And I think under the plain language of the statute, they do.
But the statute doesn't speak to when the hearing is held. It speaks to when the hearing is set, and it was, in fact, set for March 5th, and there was no jury demand made. So
certainly,
there was a waiver then at that point. If the you agree, right, if the hearing had, in fact, been held on March 5th, the jury was waived, the jury demand was
correct.
Waived.
Correct. If the hearing had proceeded on perhaps the March 5th date and the jury demand had not been filed, certainly without an adjournment on that date, that individual would not have been able to have a jury trial because the county didn't receive appropriate notice, which I think is what this statute is about. It's about protecting the county's right to have notice of a jury demand. But when the final hearing is set for a different time, if a jury demand is filed 48 hours before that time, it wouldn't be waived for that hearing.
What is your best argument as to what in the statute or case law revives this right to a jury trial?
I don't think it's a matter of reviving the right to a jury trial. I believe the correct interpretation is that when a final hearing is set, the individual has the right to file a jury demand 48 hours before that final hearing. And the words of the statute don't specify that it has to be the first date set for final hearing or the original date set for final hearing. It simply says time set for final hearing.
But respectfully, my question related to the language of the statute or case law that drives your analysis. I mean, you did say to Justice Bradley that it's waived If this would have proceeded on the 5th, it's waived.
Correct.
So something must create this new life into the ability to request a jury in a case like this. What is it that I use the word revives that right in case law or the statute? What is it that makes that happen, that makes your argument work under the language of the statute or case law?
And again, this is where we are approaching this from a plain language perspective, which requires us to look at the words that the legislature actually enacted into law and look at those words using the common, ordinary, and accepted meaning of those words. What is the statute telling us? And when we look at the words chosen by the legislature, they don't indicate that it's specifically restricting that right to a jury trial to the first date set. A jury trial is deemed waived unless demanded 48 hours in advance of the time set for final hearing. It doesn't include words that would indicate that that right only attaches to the original date set for final hearing. And again, we're talking about perhaps a limited number of cases where the final hearing is, in fact, adjourned, which can happen for a variety of reasons, including, as was the case here, appointment of new counsel.
What significance, counsel, do you give to the word final?
Final hearing is just the word that is used for the essentially the contested hearing in these 51 cases. That's the language that's used. When these cases are adjourned, they're adjourned for a final hearing. So in this case, the March 5th date was a final hearing, and the March 12th date was also a final hearing.
How would you address the decision from the Court of Appeals in RJO in regard to timeliness?
RJO was a broad, sweeping decision that handed down a number of different holdings. This was not the threshold issue in this case. This is one of several issues in that case. And I'll note that when you look at the Court of Appeals analysis regarding the jury demand issue, the Court of Appeals doesn't cite to a single principle of statutory interpretation in rendering its conclusion that the plain language indicates the reverse of our position today. It also doesn't cite to a single case. I believe it's a little over a page of analysis in a lengthy decision that is addressing a number of different issues that were present in this very complicated fact-specific case. I simply do believe that the Court of Appeals didn't use the right legal analysis in reaching its conclusion regarding plain language.
So are you asking us to overrule, because they do make a specific holding on timeliness?
I am asking the Court to overturn RJO. RJO did hand down essentially it's a plain language interpretation that I just don't think comports with well-established principles of statutory interpretation. So I am asking the Court to overturn that, because ultimately the Court of Appeals in this case was bound by that holding. The Court of Appeals and RJO didn't leave room in its holding to distinguish.
Can you think of any other scenarios where the right to a jury trial is revived, or you have a new right to request or demand a jury trial after the time has come and gone?
In the context of what's complicated is that different parts of the statute have different rules regarding jury demands. Certainly we know that in a criminal case, a person can revive that right to a jury trial is continued throughout the proceeding. Now, I was able to point to in my brief other sections of the statute that include language like if the jury demand is not filed within a certain amount of time, forever waived or permanently waived. And I think that suggests perhaps an understanding on the part of the legislature that if the intention is for the jury trial right to essentially only attach to a specific date, it knows to include language. And I think it's reasonable to believe that if the legislature intended for the right to a jury trial to be limited to, in this case, the first date set for final hearing, the legislature would have made that plain and clear. But they didn't do that in this case, and I
Counsel,
think that's notable.
Counsel, how does your argument about the intent of the legislature square with our opinion in Kalal about how we interpret a statute?
Well, one thing I'll note is that there's, when we're talking about plain language interpretation, we just look to the words enacted by the legislature. And in this case, the words enacted by the legislature do not indicate that the right to a jury trial is limited to that first date for final hearing. The words simply do not say that. And in a plain language case, I think we can start and stop with the words enacted by the legislature, which was time set for final hearing, not first time set for final hearing, not original time set for final hearing. I do think, Justice, I think Ziegler's question is an appropriate one to consider maybe the broader context of what can be seen in other statutes when they're trying to effectuate or indicate their intent with the words chosen. But I do think here the analysis can start and stop with the words actually enacted into law. And here, the words enacted into law do not indicate that the right to file a jury demand is limited to the original or first date set for final hearing.
I think in your, and I'm sorry, I can't remember if it was the first brief you filed or the second brief that you filed, but you talked about the fact that this statute in particular contemplates the fact that there may have to be more than one hearing that is scheduled. Can you talk about that for a second?
Certainly. Well, there are provisions in the Chapter 51 statute that indicate essentially the limitations for adjournments. There is another provision in 512011, just a little bit farther down in that paragraph, that indicates that in order to accommodate a jury trial, it has to be held within 14 days of the demand. And that case, or that statute, has been interpreted in the matter of GOT, which is a Court of Appeals case, to say that a final hearing can necessarily cause an extension to be involuntarily extended for the purposes of accommodating a jury trial. So in that way, the statute does provide circumstances where a case can be adjourned. And in this case, it was adjourned by 7 days to facilitate the appointment of new counsel.
Thank you.
Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, I'm wondering if you have any questions. I want to make sure we create the opportunity for you. Are you there?
Thank you. The pause was due to my locating the unmute button. I have no questions at this time, but I certainly may, as the case questions advance and the argument unfolds. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. You're not here physically, so I wanted to make sure that you had the opportunity at a minimum. So,
I very much appreciate your asking this. I think it appropriate for folks to know that the reason for my non-appearance is because of concerns about COVID safety in the hearing room. And so I'm appearing by telephone at least for our oral arguments today. But thanks for asking, and I'll try to interrupt with a loud voice or await your
Okay. Traditionally, that's not a problem, so I'll just count on that in the future. Thanks.
Thank you very much. I want to note that ultimately what the statute seeks to protect is the county's right to 48 hours notice of a jury demand being filed. And nothing about this interpretation infringes on that right. We are not proposing that the county should be deprived of 48 hours notice. In fact, this rule would indicate that if a final hearing is adjourned, the county must receive 48 hours notice. In this way, this interpretation protects both the rights of individuals subject to commitments who want to be able to litigate their case before a jury, while also protecting the county's right to notice. Another important
No worries. I sometimes worry about unintended consequences. And when I look at 80501, jury trial of right, in a civil matter. Now, criminal matters are different, so let's just put those aside. But a civil matter, there the demand has to be made at the scheduling conference or before the scheduling conference or pretrial conference, whichever is held first. So in civil cases, there's usually discovery and a lot of things that lead up to, so you have more time. Here, obviously, these are matters that have pressing time limits, right?
Correct.
So the legislature wouldn't use that same language. Do you think if we were to accept your interpretation, there may be any implications to 801 and the waiver provisions thereunder?
I do not. I think this plain language interpretation only applies to this very specific statute that's present in 5120 sub-11. And Chapter 51 cases, while civil, are unique in that they implicate fundamental rights of individuals. There is a strong liberty interest at stake here. We are saying that these individuals need to be subject to the care and custody of the government, not because of criminal behavior, but because of mental illness. And as a result, I think it's appropriate that Chapter 5120 includes its own provision regarding jury trials. So I don't believe that there would be a ripple effect into other parts of the statute, because it does specifically contemplate final hearings, which are, I don't believe that that's a term that's frequently used in other parts of the statutes.
Okay, so it says it has to be deemed waived unless demanded at least 48 hours in advance of the time set for final hearing. It doesn't say in advance of the final hearing. It says the time set. So that presumably puts everyone on notice. If you're going to have a final hearing, the time set for that final hearing, your clock ticks, and you've got to make a demand at least 48 hours before the time set. And then when I compare that to 80501, it has no such time set language. It really uses the actual conference, which is a scheduling conference or pretrial conference. It doesn't say you have to make the demand at the time set for that. It says you have to make the demand at or before the event, the scheduling conference or the pretrial conference. Why do you think the legislature didn't put in 80501 the time set for the scheduling conference or pretrial conference?
I think for a few reasons, the main one being that, as the justices have noted, there are very short timelines in these cases. So the days are calculated not in terms of business days, but in terms of hours. So they use the term time set in the context of 51 cases because there's a literal time of day by which a jury demand has to be filed. If it's set at 1 o'clock on Wednesday, it needs to be filed before 1 o'clock on Monday, which I think is why there is that difference in the statutes. And again, I think hopefully to alleviate the justices' concerns about this is a plain language interpretation issue. So we are only interpreting the words in this particular statute, and these words are not identical, nor do they particularly closely mirror the words used in other portions of the statute. I think it would actually be quite a limited holding that we're talking about here.
Can I direct your attention to 5120 sub 2 sub B? When it's talking about kind of the general rights that an individual has, in that part, the legislature chose the words a jury trial if requested more than 48 hours prior to the final hearing, and doesn't talk about the time set for final hearing. What do you make of that?
I think it's makes the timing a little bit more confusing for the litigants. I think the time set is the appropriate language, because ultimately when we're talking about 48 hours notice, that requires that there be a time of day. I don't know if that's an oversight on the part of the legislature or just a recognition that later on in the specific jury trial provision of the statute, they go into more detail about what is meant in terms of the time of day that anchors the jury demand deadline.
So in 4831 sub 2, it also is in the Children's Code dealing with a jury trial demand. And there, for example, there's a right to a jury trial by demanding a jury trial at any time before or during the plea hearing. You know, there's different language chosen in each of these. Why do you think the legislature would choose different language in each of these three statutes that deal with jury trial demands?
I think it could be for a variety of reasons. I will note that Chapter 51 has, I believe, some of the tightest deadlines of any provision in a statute. So it necessarily requires more specificity in terms of the timing of the demand, just to ensure that everyone knows what to expect and that the circuit courts are able to adequately facilitate their calendars. Whereas other portions of the statute, the circuit courts, by nature of perhaps the more flexible time of those cases, are better able to perhaps accept a jury demand that's made on the day of the court hearing. It also, those cases might also presume more hearings than are likely going to happen in a 51 case, which proceed in very short, quick fashion.
Yeah, isn't it a little dangerous to not make a timely jury demand first final hearing date? I mean, then you're really hoping that the court might adjourn it.
I think you're correct. Certainly the best practice would be to file, if the attorney has been appointed, the client is available, they're able to make contact, and they have the ability to file that jury demand, that needs to be done. I think there's no question. This is where the circuit court's discretion comes into play, because if the parties appear at a final hearing and a jury demand has not been filed, the circuit court can exercise its discretion, as it does in any other kind of case, and assess the requests for an adjournment and decide if an adjournment is reasonable given the facts presented by both sides. I'll also note that in the context of a request for an adjournment, the county would also have the opportunity to make available to the court any concerns that they might have.
Do you think the legislature in these time-sensitive matters might have selected to use this language because they wanted to make clear you have to do it 48 hours before this date that the court has to set by law fairly quickly?
Certainly. I do notice that I just ran out of time. Can I answer your question?
Yeah. Yes, please.
I believe the legislature set out the 48-hour deadline to set the expectation for all of the parties. But when a final hearing is adjourned, a new time has been set for final hearing, and thus that new 48-hour deadline comes into play. And if, when the parties appear, a demand has not been filed and the request for adjournment is not reasonable, the circuit court, in its discretion, can make that decision to adjourn or to not adjourn.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Bosch.
I'm only slightly taller than Attorney Breckenfelder.
There is a button on your right-hand side to raise the podium. Is that enough?
I did. I think it's enough, and I'll adjust from here. How about that? I don't want to hide behind the podium either.
Okay. Thank you.
It is a large enough podium, unfortunately. Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Attorney Zach Bosch. I represent Waukesha County Corporation Council and the public in this matter before the court. We have to remember that Chapter 51 is a treatment statute. It's not a punishment statute. It puts us in the civil law, not the criminal law. When Attorney Breckenfelder is talking about the adjourned final hearing being another final hearing, and that somehow revives an already statutorily waived deadline, the problem with that is that adjourned final hearing is still linked back to that petition for extension that we're actually there on. So we've already, the jury demand, or the right to a jury trial, is linked to the petition for extension. And just because you adjourn the final hearing, that waiver has already gone through. In this particular case with EJW, we got to court on March 5th, 2019. That waiver had already taken place relative to the petition before the court. And simply adjourning that hearing to March 12th of 2019 can't simply revive an already statutorily waived deadline. It's related to the petition before the court, not the final hearing or what hearing we call it.
Counsel, what happens if a jury trial is requested for the first hearing, but the hearing is set over, and then another date is set, and then that hearing is set over, And then another date is set, so you end up with three dates, which is not at all unusual in Chapter 51. Okay, so now you've got a hearing date that may be 6 weeks from the date at which it was first set. Do you continue to honor a jury trial request that was made for the first hearing when the focus of the hearing may not really want a jury trial anymore? But since it's there, does the court then have to call a jury for that day?
Yeah, I would say yes, Your Honor. And the reason being is that once that jury demand is made, the court and the county in this case are proceeding as though we're having a jury trial. Now, that we may not know when exactly that date is, but normally, at least in Waukesha County, on March 5th, if there had been a timely jury demand and we come to court on March 5th, the court is scheduling the jury trial that day, and it would likely have been on March 12th, presumably. And so we come back on March 12th for that jury trial. The court, once there is a jury demand, we do have the issue of the 14 days that we have to have that jury trial actually held within. So when, if a jury demand had been made 48 hours prior to March 5th, we'll just say March 3rd for argument's sake, we only have until March 17th to actually have that.
Well, what if the hearing is set later than that? You get beyond the 14 days that's elsewhere in the statute. Does there have to be another demand for a jury trial? Or does the one that you started out with carry no matter when the hearing, the final hearing is set?
If the jury trial wasn't held within the 14-day time window, and there was not a stipulation from opposing counsel, and we'll say EJW in this case, I think we'd be before this court arguing about whether the court lost competency to actually hear the petition for extension at that point.
Well, hearing with a jury trial is one thing. Competency, as you know, is a very complicated issue, and sometimes it causes problems for us, and sometimes not. But it's your position, then, that because it has to be made with the hearing, has to be within, with the jury, within 14 days of the date set for the hearing initially. If it's not, then there is no right to a jury trial if the hearing is held 3 weeks later rather than 14 days later? I'm not sure I understand your position.
So, and I'll try to explain how I'm answering your question. So, yeah. My understanding of your question is that there is no jury, we'll use that March 5th date again. No jury demand is made. We come to court on March 5th. It's adjourned, and maybe it's adjourned two or three times from that point in time.
Yeah.
Yes, the argument is that there is, the waiver has already occurred at that point.
But what if there was? What if there was a request for a jury trial made, okay, within 48 hours of the first date that was set? But because of setovers, you end up 3 weeks later having the actual final hearing. Do they have to request again a jury trial? Because obviously the 14 days expired during which the county had to proceed with the jury trial. Who gets stuck with the burden? Is it the focus of the hearing, or is it the county? Where are we?
The county, being myself, I would be stomping my feet in court asking that it be held within that 14 days. We don't allow it, at least in Waukesha County, once there's a jury demand, we don't allow it to go outside the 14 days. If the jury demand is made, you're going to have a jury trial. I had that 2 weeks ago. We had a jury trial. The jury demand was timely filed. We had it within, I think, 10 days of the jury demand.
But isn't the issue really, once you make the demand, you have the right to the jury trial? You could waive that later if you wanted to proceed without it and have a court trial. But the jury demand is made, and it's valid so long as made 48 hours before the final hearing date and the time set for a final hearing. And if it's later waived, or if somehow it were to proceed later, the issue wouldn't necessarily be did you make a valid jury demand. The issue would be whether the court is still able to hear that proceeding given that it went beyond 14 days. But the jury demand remains valid. I don't see anything that makes that extinguish in the statute, do you?
No, and I agree. It still remains valid. And if, as long as it was timely filed at least 48 hours prior to the time set for final hearing, that jury demand should go forward. That jury trial should go forward. Even if it has to be, we'll say for the sake of argument, we'll say that it has to be set 21 days. Now, I don't agree with it being set 21 days. I would still, if that's where we came to, if there was a waiver of the 14-day time window, whatever it may be, that jury trial would still move forward. I do believe that it would be a valid jury demand. and that you would have that opportunity for that jury
so
trial.
That's what was bothering me, that even after the 2 week period goes by, if there was a jury demand made, then you have to have a jury trial when you do eventually have the hearing. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Until that individual waives that jury trial. We have cases where certain attorneys will automatically, they're appointed on the case, automatically file the jury demand to protect that right.
Yeah.
And then the court and the county begin rescheduling cases, trying to prepare for that particular jury trial. And then we get to what is that originally scheduled final hearing. We'll say March 5th is that first date. And the person says, I'm going to waive my right to a jury trial today. And they ask for a 7-day adjournment. We adjourn it 7 days, and we have the final hearing on March 12th. That happens quite frequently, but we are preparing to go forward with a jury trial until the person places on the record that they're waiving their right to that jury trial at that point.
Counsel, your opposing counsel frames the argument as whether this may not be her words, but whether a rescheduled time set for hearing is what the statute's referring to, whether it's the initial time set for hearing. Do you agree that that is the dispute before us, or would you frame it differently?
I believe the dispute is that there is a final hearing and that there is notice of that final hearing provided either to the person or their counsel. In this case, it was provided to both. And so that final hearing notice said March 5th of 2019. That's the date. That's the date that starts that 48-hour clock, because the statute doesn't just end with time set for final hearing. It says if notice was provided of that date.
Right.
That time.
But it kind of matters. I mean, you know, I understand the facts of this case, but obviously any decision we make, we're going to have to apply to other cases. So what I want to understand is do you think the initial time set for hearing is the time, or would you think a properly noticed, rescheduled time set for hearing is also a statutory time set for hearing?
Can I ask a clarification, Justice?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Is the adjourned hearing happening before or after that 48-hour timeline has run?
I'm asking, actually, all of the above. So yes and no. I want to know your answer. If your answer changes, I'd like to know that. Yeah.
If the request for the adjournment, and we'll say March 5th is the hearing date that notice is originally provided, before 48 hours has come, somebody requests an adjournment, and the court pushes that to, we'll say, March 12th, and that's properly noticed to everyone. I believe then at that time, March 12th becomes that date, that 48-hour date, because it happened before that 48-hour timeline had run.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not reviving anything. You're just simply shifting all of those already still intact rights. You're just shifting them a week. If we'll say, for example, on March 5th, on March 4th, there's a request for an adjournment, so now you're only 24 hours in advance. Well, that waiver's already occurred, and the court can obviously adjourn that to March 12th, but that waiver has already occurred, and so the only thing that's shifting over is just that final hearing is shifting over. The waiver has already taken place.
So your counsel, in her reply brief, she makes this hypothetical. She says, presume the committee's final hearing was scheduled for April 15th, an attorney's appointed April 10th, but due to a scheduling conflict was unavailable on April 15th, so the hearing's reset to April 20th. And as her hypothetical continues, jury demand comes April 16th. But that's before 48 hours, before the new rescheduled time set for hearing, but after the initial time set for hearing. Your position, if I'm understanding you correctly, in response to that, would be because a new time set for hearing was set before 48 hours, that is a valid reschedule. That becomes a new time set for hearing. But is that right? Is that accurate?
Yes, because okay. that waiver is still there. Well, it hasn't actually occurred yet.
Okay.
That right to a jury trial is still intact. If you wait until after that 48 hours has run, it's no longer intact. It's already been waived, and there's no right any further.
Sure. So similarly, I suppose if the hearing, same scenario, hearing scheduled for April 15th, that's moved up to April 14th, but still scheduled on April 10th, you wouldn't say the time set for hearing is in the original notice of April 15th. You would say it's now April 14th. Is that right?
I would, but I think in that scenario, I find it I'll just say that typically in Waukesha County, we're not going to move a hearing up. It's always going to move back. But say for the sake of argument that it does.
Assume judges had free and open calendars and could schedule them whenever it works. Yes.
In that scenario, I would not object if the jury demand came in 48 hours prior to the 15th, if the hearing had been rescheduled to the 14th, solely because I can understand where, from counsel's position, for the individual, how that obviously shrinks the timeline without hardly any notice that it's going to be shrunk. That's a little bit of a different situation of moving that timeline forward or closer without telling anybody that that's happening. And so I can understand how that would happen. I think that's a discretionary issue at that point. And I would not, as representing the county, would not object to that jury demand.
But the issue isn't whether or not...
I'm sorry, can I ask one follow-up?
Of course.
Justice Kroski, thank you. Do you feel that your argument that you've made here, that the 48 hours really is the trigger, it's not the notice, but it's only if it's rescheduled within that 48 hours, is that argument the same thing the Court of Appeals said in the cases that it's addressed this in, or is your argument different than what they've said in your view?
I believe it's the same, because if we look at RJO, that's really the only published case on point on this issue. In RJO, RJO didn't appear at the August 10th hearing date, at the advice of counsel, no less, and a jury demand was filed August 12th of 2016, so 2 days after. The final hearing didn't recommence until a full year later. I believe it was June of 2017 when it was actually finally recommenced after RJO had been detained. The jury demand for that final hearing was refiled at least 48 hours in advance of that new final hearing date, and the court held, no, August 10th was that date. It was properly noticed. 48 hours came and went, and you waived your statutory deadline or your statutory waiver. I think that still comports, my argument here today still comports with the RJO case, because that waiver already occurred if you've already gone past that 48 hours.
So in essence, this case, in your view, boils down to whether sort of there is a, to use your opposing counsel's words, once waived, always waived. Once you hit that 48-hour time frame, they can be rescheduled, they can be all that sort of stuff, you're fine with it. The time set for final hearing isn't the initial notice, in your view. It is a rescheduled notice unless it's within 48 hours. And if so, once waived, always waived, that's the end of the matter, in your view.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Justice Kroski, I know you had...
Counsel, I'm a little confused with what you said about adjournments. I get the once waived, always waived argument. But what I don't understand is you seem to be saying that the magic is in when it's adjourned, when the request is made. Can you show me in the statute where that even talks? I mean, it talks about the time set for final hearing. Why does it matter when an adjournment request is made or not made for purposes of the jury demand?
Well, because if the request comes before the 48 hours, that jury demand is still in, or that jury trial right is still intact.
Well, stop. Can I stop you there? Where in the statute does it say that? It doesn't say unless adjourned within 48 hours. It doesn't, I don't get from point A to point B.
Sure.
I hear you, but get me from point A to point B.
I would agree that the statute doesn't specifically say any of that, but what the statute does allow under 5120.10e is it does allow for that brief adjournment up to 7 days at the request of the individual. And so because it allows for that adjournment, it seems, honestly, I believe it's just a logical argument that if it's made before the 48-hour jury demand deadline runs, then that just stays intact because we're still on notice that that right is still available to the person. We're still on notice that they may very well request that jury demand at that adjourned date. But if it has already gone by and that waiver has already occurred, the county, the court, are proceeding as though there is no jury trial, whether it's adjourned or not.
So what's the magic to that, though? I mean, this is a case involving the right to a jury trial for someone who is being committed. So yes, it's a civil case, but it is also has a deprivation of liberty, so maybe a heightened standard, not your typical civil case. The proof you're going to give is exactly the same. The witnesses you're going to give is exactly the same. Isn't the purpose of the 48-hour notice so that the court has time to call a jury, to actually get the physical people there? So I'm not understanding why it matters that the court's on notice or not on notice as to when that adjournment comes into place. That doesn't seem to connect.
Well, in 51s, as Attorney Breckenfelder noted, there are very strict timelines on when these things happen. So when we're talking about when... in this particular case, it's an extension hearing. But what about in a final hearing for an initial commitment? In that, we have to have the hearing from the time the person is emergently detained to final hearing is 14 days. I mean, that, unless there's a jury demand, and then that maybe extends a little bit, and it can extend up to 21 days. So if much of this is kind of an in-between civil law, and we heard about the 20 days or, you know, having to have it at a pretrial conference versus criminal law where it's presumed that you're going to have a jury trial until you say otherwise, this falls somewhere in between. It's not the extended time period of filing a jury demand, and it's not you can ask for or you can, you know, keep that jury trial right until you say otherwise. It falls somewhere in the middle. And part of that timeline, the reason it's only 48 hours versus 20 is because of these timelines. They're quick turnarounds. And we don't want people, I believe in 1975 this court put out a decision that ultimately led to essentially the rewriting of the Chapter 51 code because people were being on an initial commitment, emergency detention, people were being left in inpatient psychiatric units for 30 days at a time before they were receiving their final hearings. And so part of the reason that we have to have these short timelines is because we don't want people sitting in psychiatric units without due process for extended periods of time. And so, yes, part of it is so the court can get a jury there. Part of it is to provide notice to the county and to the public at large. But the point is that we have to have notice because we have to have time to get that done. Because if it's done, we'll say, if we act as though EJW's case was an initial commitment and his 21 days was at, we'll say March 12th was his 21st day, and that jury demand doesn't come in until 48 hours before March 12th, Waukesha County, we're not going to be able to get a jury pool pulled together in order to have that jury trial. There's no ability to get that done.
Well, but counsel, if you have the first date for the final hearing and a demand is made under the statutory provisions, Waukesha County's got 2 days and they still have to do it in 2 days.
Right. And we would have to try to get it done. I don't know that we would be able to get it done. And primarily because I just know when the Waukesha County, when they send out their notices to the potential jurors each week, they do it once a week. And so obviously maybe procedures would have to change, but it would be very difficult. And that's why in Waukesha County, we set these matters 2 weeks before, on an extension case, 2 weeks before the expiration, is so that we have that additional built-in time where we can adjourn it out up to the 14 days to allow that time to get that jury pool pulled together and to not rush anybody and have time
counsel,
to reschedule matters.
Do we learn anything from the language of 80501, where the legislature specifically chose language where the occurrence of the event is what controls the timing with respect to a demand for a jury, the scheduling conference, the pretrial conference. Here, the legislature did not write that it is deemed waived unless demanded at least 48 hours in advance of the final hearing. It knows how to do that because it did that in 80501. Why do you think it didn't do that here if the occurrence of the final hearing is the thing that controls the 48-hour requirement?
I think it's just as what we were just talking about. It's because these timelines are so tight. These cases come in and out of court within roughly a 2 to 3 week period. A civil case may be before the court for a year, 2 years, et cetera. And because of these quick turnarounds, I think if a time set was used because the court wanted to make sure that if that hearing was adjourned, it wasn't going to be adjourned very far because of our strict timelines, that we had that notice to everyone in time so we had the ability as much time as possible to get that done.
What I hear your opposing counsel arguing is, look, this is really important. It should be 48 hours before the occurrence of the event. And if the event is set and adjourned, we get a new 48 hours to do that within. But if the legislature truly meant that, they wouldn't have that language in there. They would have made the final hearing the date by which the 48 hours is driven. It wouldn't have the time set nor need the time set language. Shouldn't we presume that the legislature knows how to make the occurrence of an event the thing that triggers the time limit if, in fact, it has done it in other sections?
Yes, and even if we look at 512011A itself, if we look at the second half of that statute after that waiver language, they use the term held, they use the term hold, and when the jury trial must be held within the 14 days of the demand. They know how to use held or hold and set. They know the difference. They did it, both of those words. They used both of those words in that statute section alone. If they had indicated that it must be 48 hours prior to the final hearing being held, or as you mentioned, prior to the final hearing, then we're having a much different argument here today. And likely I'm losing, because we would have had it done before then.
Counsel?
Yes. Justice Bradley.
Yes. The voice in the wilderness. There I am. On pages 14 and 15 of your brief, you seem to place the blame for losing the right to a jury trial squarely on EJW or any other potentially committed person who fails to act. On page 15, you suggest you could have contacted the clerk of courts or maybe Waukesha County Department, et cetera. It seems to me that placing that burden on a potentially committed person, that's both irrelevant and unfair. It's irrelevant because ultimately it's not what efforts he made or didn't make, but the language of the statute that drives our analysis. And secondly, unfair because in future cases, the person may be in the midst of some delusional event, and to place that kind of burden on a person who is at the cusp of being committed for mental health issues just seems unfair. Can you respond to it's not relevant and it's unfair?
Well, Justice Bradley, I think in Chapter 51 where that concern is alleviated is the fact that every single individual, no matter what their monetary or economic background is going to be appointed counsel. They're automatically appointed counsel when we file a petition for extension. They're automatically appointed counsel when there's a statement of emergency detention. It doesn't matter whether they have the funds to go out and hire an attorney on their own or not. They are appointed counsel to help represent their interests for the very issue that you brought up, that they may be going through a mental health crisis. They may be in an inpatient psychiatric unit. They may not be based in reality at the point in time that this is occurring, but that's the very reason they have an attorney appointed for them, so that attorney can go talk to them, can go over these rights with them a little bit further in depth, and can represent their interest at a hearing, and can ensure that these rights are maintained if necessary. Now, in EJW's case, he was appointed counsel, and there's some discussion about whether or not they were able to connect ahead of time. They weren't. It's basically what the record would reflect. But at the same time...
Counsel, in future cases, is it your position that the burden should be placed on the person subject to the commitment to contact the clerk of courts with questions and an updated phone number, to contact the state public defender more than one time, and also to contact the Waukesha County 5142 department with your correct phone number? That's what you said on page 15 was his burden and that he was responsible for doing all that. Is that your position?
Justice Bradley, I'm not the one placing that burden. The statute places that burden on EJW. The statute says that EJW has to assert that right to a jury trial by filing that jury demand at least 48 hours prior to the time set for final hearing. In my brief, I'm simply pointing out the fact that EJW wanted this jury trial so badly that he made a single phone call. He ignored a letter that indicated what phone number was on file for him and that if it was incorrect, he should contact the court to update that phone number. I'm simply pointing out all of these different avenues that EJW could have pursued if he really wanted this jury trial. He had a number of opportunities to contact either the court or his caseworker. He didn't do that. He only attempted to call his attorney one time and left one voicemail that his attorney didn't even recall receiving. His attorney tried to call him a number of times but had an incorrect phone number because EJW didn't update that phone number with anyone. The statute... Yes, Justice.
Counsel, and it's your position that his conduct is relevant to our statutory interpretation, the words set forth in the text of the statute?
I believe his conduct is relevant to EJW's particular case here today. I believe it's relevant that that the statute requires that he assert that right to a jury trial, and just pointing out that he didn't do much to try to assert that right. he is required to file that jury demand within at least 48 hours prior to the final hearing. He didn't do that, and he didn't take many steps to try to ensure that that happened either. And so in this particular case, yes, I do believe it matters. In future cases, it may not, the conduct may not matter, because ultimately I believe this is a bright line rule that puts all parties of future cases going forward that 48 hours prior to the time set for final hearing is the time that's included in that notice that's previously been provided.
But you could see the situation repeating itself over and over, right? You're busy, right? And we know that the public defenders, thank you both for your work, who represent people in these situations are also really, really busy. And so, you know, it's not surprising, first of all, that someone has the wrong phone number. It's not surprising maybe a phone call was made and it got lost in the shuffle, right? This is the exact situation, as was pointed out in EJW's brief, that causes so much consternation, which is, of course, why we are here. So I hear you, and I think what you're saying is, look, the word demand means that EJW has to do all of these things, but I think what Justice Ann Walsh Bradley is saying from the wilderness is that, look, this is an individual who is under an order of commitment, one. Two, is ordered to take medications, and it does feel like a really long laundry list, right? Like, you've been in the system, I've been in the system, but, you know, all the things that we're telling him that he needs to do, he's got to make sure everyone has his right phone number, not just his attorney, but the clerk of courts. He's got to contact the clerk's office. He's got to contact the PD's office. He's got to bring an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. You know, he's got a pattern. It feels just a lot to put on someone in EJW's position.
But, and Justice Krofsky, in EJW's situation, I'm not necessarily saying he has to do all that. I'm just pointing out that he could have done that to ensure that. The interesting point here, though, is that he is in constant or should be in constant communication with his caseworker and the 5142 board because they're constantly monitoring his treatment during the period of his commitment. In this case, I believe it was a six-month period leading up to this extension. And so normally they would have his updated phone number. He would be updating that phone number for when he's making appointments with his treating prescriber, when he's making appointments for therapy, when he's contacting his caseworker. That phone number would normally be
right,
updated.
Right. Not to cut you off, but let me just cut to the quick here. The point is he needs help. Like right? Like most people in the legal system, we need help when it's our case. We need a lawyer to help us. And that was the exact situation EJW found himself in. He gets to court. He hasn't contacted his lawyer. He hasn't filed the jury demand because he doesn't have the lawyer next to him to say, hey, you got to do this within 48 hours. Isn't that exactly what happened?
Well, and Justice Krofsky, the court took an extra step that it's not required to do, namely sending that letter saying, if this is your incorrect information, please contact the court so that we can provide it. I mean, the circuit court did try to help him. The circuit court is going above and beyond by providing this additional letter saying, this is the information we have for you. If it's incorrect, please let us know so that we can ensure that you can have that contact with your attorney, so that we can ensure that your rights are represented. He didn't do that, and that was an additional step, an additional, decision by the circuit court to make that concerted effort to help EJW.
Counsel, can I just quickly, I know your time's running short here. It's understood the point you were making in response to my questions before, that to me, I understand this case comes down to not so much the language time set for hearing, because you agree that that can be changed, but whether the time set for hearing, that once you hit that 48-hour limit, it's irrevocably waived. And I want to hear your best argument for once waived, always waived in this context based upon this statutory language.
And Chief Justice Ziegler, my red light just came on. Can I
please answer his question?
Thank you. Justice Hagedorn, in this particular case, or in any future case, I wouldn't say that it's always waived, primarily because we may be back in 6 months, we may be back in 8 months, we may be back in 12 months on another extension request. So I wouldn't ever use the word always waived for that reason. But I understand your point, at least relative to the petition that's before the court on that date, is relative to the fact that our Constitution, the Wisconsin Constitution, Article 1, Section 5, says that in civil cases, as it's prescribed by law, it can be the way in which a jury demand is filed is as prescribed by law. And here we have the state legislature prescribing to us by law in 5120 how that jury demand has to be made. And this court itself has, in a number of other civil matters, indicated whether you mean to waive it or not, in particular, Rao v. WMH Securities, whether you mean to actually waive that jury trial right or not, isn't really the point here. The point is this is the date that you have. If you didn't do it by this date, then your jury trial right is deemed waived at that point in time.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you. There are a number of really important points that I want to hit on based on counsel's arguments. This statute implicates two rights: the right of a mentally ill individual to have a jury trial, and the county's right to 48 hours of notice of a jury demand. The interpretation that I'm putting forth that I think comports with each and every word enacted into law by the statute protects both of these rights. It balances them. No party is going to be deprived of that right unjustly. But I think as the justices' questions pointed out and counsel's arguments point out, under the county's interpretation, the county's right to not just 48 hours notice, but 48 hours notice before the first time set for final hearing trumps an individual's right to a jury trial. The statute doesn't call for that, and it's simply not necessary. This interpretation that I'm putting forth appropriately allows the circuit court to serve as the gatekeeper for adjournments, ensuring that the county will always have the required 48 hours notice under the statute, and that individuals will be able to assert their right to a jury trial when it's done appropriately and in situations like the one that was faced here, where the individual, I believe, through no fault of his own, was unable to connect with their attorney and get this jury demand filed. There are many situations that we can imagine where, with a short deadline, 48 hours, an individual and their attorney are not able to connect, be it because of the attorney's inaction, an emergency, their schedule, an SPD problem with appointing counsel. The interpretation that I'm putting forth ensures that the county will receive 48 hours notice as required by law and avoids these situations where an individual will unjustly be deprived of their jury trial.
How does your argument give any effect to the language in the statute, time set for? Because as I understand your argument, it really is reading out some language. I understand your argument is that your friend on the other side is adding a word. But under your argument, the statute could simply say a jury trial is deemed waived unless demanded at least 48 hours in advance of the final hearing. So how do you give any effect to time set for?
Certainly, and I think my interpretation does give effect to that, which is an important point because part of the goal of statutory interpretation is to give full effect to each of the words chosen. I think I gave this example in my brief. If a final hearing is set for 2 o'clock in the afternoon on a Wednesday, then that individual and their attorney know that the jury demand has to be filed by 2 p.m. on that Monday. If the court had, or if the legislature had instead used the word, it must be demanded by 48 hours before the time the hearing is held, the timing of the jury demand would just be a moving target, because if the hearing actually moved forward because of calendar congestion at 3 o'clock, then maybe a jury demand filed at 2:30 would be timely, but there would be no way to know that. So what the time set language does is it gives the precise time of day at which the jury demand needs to be filed, which is a little distinct from other areas of the statute that work more in terms of business days. The short timelines here require using deadlines in terms of actual time of day.
But it doesn't need to say that in order to accept your argument, because, for example, if, in fact, the hearing is held at 2 p.m. on pick a day, as it was scheduled for, then the party knows that it has been scheduled for that time, so then the party knows he has 48 hours before then to file the jury demand. So I don't see your argument giving any work to do to time set for language.
And I guess I would indicate that in the context of a first date set for final hearing or a second date set for final hearing, it's still important for that time set language to be included in the statute because it gives clarity to everybody regarding what time of day essentially you can expect a jury demand to be filed. And again, I think the issue before this court is whether or not this statute as written limits the filing of a jury demand to the first date set for final hearing, otherwise it's waived. I don't believe the language says that, and I also take a bit of issue with, I think, the county's proposal that the timing of when an adjournment is requested should be dispositive here. I think that will necessarily lead to absurd and unfair results. It's not written into the statute that requires reading, frankly, an additional rule into the statute, which I simply don't think is called for. So I would ask the court to adopt our holding.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the arguments today. Very interesting case. All right. We will adjourn and reconvene for the second case in a bit.